Chapter 32. Action never seemed to hang in mystic suspense between the contradictory speculations and judgments disputing the possession of his will. It was not what Belarab would either suddenly do, or leisurely determine upon that Lingard was afraid of. The danger was that in his taciturn hesitation, which had something hopelessly godlike in its remote calmness, the man would do nothing and leave his white friend face, to face with unruly impulses against which Lingard had no means of action, but force which he dared not use since it would mean the destruction of his plans, and the downfall of his hopes, and worse still would wear an aspect of treachery to Assam and Amata, those fugitives whom he had snatched away from the jaws of death on a night of storm, and had promised to lead back in triumph to their own country he had seen but once, sleeping unmoved under the wrath and fire of heaven. On the afternoon of the very day he had arrived with her on board the Emma, to the infinite disgust of Jorgensen, Lingard held with Mrs. Travers after as he had had a couple of hours' rest, a long, fiery, and perplexed conversation. From the nature of the problem it could not be exhaustive, but toward the end of it, they were both feeling thoroughly exhausted. Mrs. Travers had no longer to be instructed as to facts and possibilities. She was aware of them only too well, and it was not her part to advise or argue. She was not called upon to decide or to plead. The situation was far beyond that. But she was worn out with watching the passionate conflict within the man who was both so desperately reckless, and so rigidly restrained in the very ardor of his heart, and the greatness of his soul. It was a spectacle that made her forget the actual questions at issue. This was no stage play, and yet as he had caught herself looking at him with bated breath, as at a great actor on a darkened stage in some simple and tremendous drama, he extorted from her a response to the forces that seemed to tear at his single-minded brain, at his guileless breast. He shook her with his own struggles, he possessed her with his emotions, and imposed his personality, as if its tragedy were the only thing worth considering in this matter. And yet what had she to do with all those obscure and barbarous things? Obviously nothing. Unluckily, as he had been taken into the confidence of that man's passionate perplexity, a confidence provoked apparently by nothing but the power of her personality. She was flattered, and even more, she was touched by it. She was aware of something that resembled gratitude, and provoked a sort of emotional return, as between equals who had secretly recognized each other's value. Yet at the same time she regretted not having been left in the dark, as much in the dark as Mr. Travers himself or Delcasser, though as to the latter it was impossible to say how much precise, unaccountable intuitive knowledge was buried under his unruffled manner. Delcasser was the sort of man whom it would be much easier to suspect of anything in the world than ignorance or stupidity. Naturally he couldn't know anything definite, or even guess at the bare outline of the facts, but somehow he must have scented the situation in those few days of contact with Lingard. He was an acute and sympathetic observer in all his secret aloofness from the life of men, which was so very different from Jorgensen's secret divorce from the passions of this earth. Mrs. Travers would have liked to share with Delcasser the burden, for it was a burden, of Lingard's story. After all, as he had not provoked those confidences, neither had that unexpected adventurer from the sea laid on her an obligation of secrecy. No, not even by implication. He had never said to her that she was the only person whom he wished to know that story. No. What he had said was that she was the only person to whom he could tell the tale himself, as if no one else on earth had the power to draw it from him. That was the sense and nothing more. Yes, it would have been a relief to tell Delcasser. It would have been a relief to her feeling of being shut off from the world alone with Lingard, as if within the four walls of a romantic palace and in an exotic atmosphere. Yes, that relief and also another. That of sharing the responsibility with somebody fit to understand. Yet she shrank from it, with unaccountable reserve, as if by talking of Lingard with Delcasser she was bound to give him an insight into herself. It was a vague uneasiness, and yet so persistent, that she felt it too, when as he had to approach and talk to lingered under Delcasser's eyes. Not that Mr. Delcasser would ever dream of staring, or even casting glances. But was he averting his eyes on purpose? That would be even more offensive. I am stupid, whispered Mrs. Travers to herself, with a complete and reassuring conviction. Yet she waited motionless till the footsteps of the two men stopped outside the deck house, then separated and died away, before she went out on deck. She came out on deck some time after her husband. As if in intended contrast to the conflicts of men, a great aspect of serenity lay upon all visible things. Mr. Travers had gone inside the cage in which he really looked like a captive and thoroughly out of place. Delcasser had gone in there too, but he preserved, or was it an illusion? An air of independence. It was not that he put it on. Like Mr. Travers, he sat in a wicker armchair in very much the same attitude as the other gentleman and also silent, but there was somewhere a subtle difference which did away with the notion of captivity. Moreover, Delcasser had that peculiar gift of never looking out of place in any surroundings. Mrs. Travers, in order to save her European boots for active service, had been persuaded to use a pair of leather sandals also extracted from that seaman's chest in the deck house. An additional fastening had been put on them, but she could not avoid making a delicate clatter as she walked on the deck. No part of her costume made her feel so exotic. It also forced her to alter her usual gait and move with quick, short steps very much like Amata. I am robbing the girl of her clothes, as he had thought to herself, besides other things. She knew by this time that a girl of such high rank would never dream of wearing anything that had been worn by somebody else. At the slight noise of Mrs. Travers' sandals, Delcasser looked over the back of his chair. But he turned his head away at once, and Mrs. Travers, leaning her elbow on the rail, and resting her head on the palm of her hand, looked across the calm surface of the lagoon, idly. She was turning her back on the cage, the fore part of the deck, and the edge of the nearest forest. That great erection of enormous solid trunks, dark, rugged columns festooned with writhing creepers and steeped in gloom, was so close to the bank that by looking over the side of the ship she could see inverted in the glassy belt of water its massive and black reflection on the reflected sky that gave the impression of a clear blue abyss seen through a transparent film. And when she raised her eyes, the same abysmal immobility seemed to reign over the whole sun-bathed enlargement of that lagoon which was one of the secret places of the earth. She felt strongly her isolation. She was so much the only being of her kind moving within this mystery, that even to herself she looked like an apparition without rights, and without defense, and that must end by surrendering to those forces which seemed to her but the expression of the unconscious genius of the place. Hers was the most complete loneliness, charged with a catastrophic tension. It lay about her, as though as he had been set apart within a magic circle. It cut off, but it did not protect. The footsteps that she knew how to distinguish above all others on that deck were heard suddenly behind her. She did not turn her head. Since that afternoon when the gentleman, as Lingard called them, had been brought on board, Mrs. Travers and Lingard had not exchanged one significant word. When Lingard had decided to proceed by way of negotiation, as he had asked him on what he based his hope of success, and he had answered her colon on my luck. What he really depended on was his prestige. But even if he had been aware of such a word, he would not have used it, since it would have sounded like a boast. And, besides, he did really believe in his luck. Nobody, either white or brown, had ever doubted his word, and that, of course, gave him great assurance in entering upon the negotiation. But the ultimate issue of it would be always a matter of luck. He said so distinctly to Mrs. Travers at the moment of taking leave of her, with Jorgensen already waiting for him in the boat that was to take them across the lagoon to Bellerup's stockade. Startled by his decision, for it had come suddenly, clinched by the words, believe I can do it. Mrs. Travers had dropped her hand into his strong open palm on which an expert in palmistry could have distinguished other lines than the line of luck. Lingard's hand closed on hers with a gentle pressure. She looked at him, speechless. He waited for a moment, then in an unconsciously tender voice he said, "Colin, well, wish me luck then." She remained silent, and he still holding her hand looked surprised at her hesitation. It seemed to her that she could not let him go, and she didn't know what to say till it occurred to her to make use of the power she knew as he had over him. She would try it again. I am coming with you, she declared with decision. You don't suppose I could remain here in suspense for hours, perhaps? He dropped her hand suddenly, as if it had burnt him. Yes, of course, he mumbled with an air of confusion. One of the men over there was her husband, and nothing less could be expected from such a woman. He had really nothing to say, but she thought he hesitated. Oh, you think my presence would spoil everything? I assure you I am a lucky person too, in a way. As lucky as you, at least, as he had added in a murmur, and with a smile which provoked his responsive mutter. Yes, we are a lucky pair of people. Count myself lucky in having found a man like you to fight my our battles, she said, warmly. As suppose you had not existed? You must let me come with you. For the second time before her expressed wish to stand by his side, he bowed his head. After all, if things came to the worst, she would be as safe between him and Jorgensen as left alone on board the Emma with a few Malay spearmen for all defense. For a moment Lingard thought of picking up the pistols he had taken out of his belt preparatory to joining Jorgensen in the boat, thinking it would be better to go to a big talk completely unarmed. They were lying on the rail, but he didn't pick them up. Four shots didn't matter. They could not matter if the world of his creation were to go to pieces. He said nothing of that to Mrs. Travers, but busied himself in giving her the means to alter her personal appearance. It was then that the sea chest in the deckhouse was opened for the first time before the interested Mrs. Travers who had followed him inside. Lingard handed to her a Malay woman's light cotton coat with jeweled clasps to put over her European dress. It covered half of her yachting skirt. Mrs. Travers obeyed him without comment. He pulled out a long and wide scarf of white silk embroidered heavily on the edges and ends, and begged her to put it over her head, and arrange the end so as to muffle her face, leaving little more than her eyes exposed to view. "We are going amongst a lot of Mohammedans," he explained. "See? You want me to look respectable," she jested. "Assure you, Mrs. Travers," he protested earnestly, "that most of the people there, and certainly all the great men, have never seen a white woman in their lives. But perhaps you would like better one of those other scarves? There are three in there. Oh, I like this one well enough. They are all very gorgeous. I see that the princess is to be sent back to her land with all possible splendor. What a thoughtful man you are, Captain Lingard. That child will be touched by your generosity. Will I do like this?" "Yes," said Lingard, averting his eyes. Mrs. Travers followed him into the boat, where the Malay stared in silence while Jorgensen, stiff and angular, gave no sign of life, not even so much as a movement of the eyes. Lingard settled her in the stern sheets, and sat down by her side. The ardent sunshine devoured all colors. The boat swam forward on the glare heading for the strip of coral beach dazzling like a crescent of metal raised to a white heat. They landed. Gravely, Jorgensen opened above Mrs. Travers' head a big white cotton parasol, and she advanced between the two men, dazed, as if in a dream, and having no other contact with the earth, but through the soles of her feet. Everything was still, empty, incandescent, and fantastic. Then when the gate of the stockade was thrown open she perceived an expectant and still multitude of bronze figures draped in colored stuffs. They crowded the patches of shade under the three lofty forest trees left within the enclosure between the sun-smitten empty spaces of hard-baked ground. The broad blades of the spears decorated with crimson tufts of horsehair had a cool gleam under the outspread boughs. To the left, a group of buildings on piles with long verandas and immense roofs towered high in the air above the heads of the crowd, and seemed to float in the glare, looking much less substantial than their heavy shadows. Lingard, pointing to one of the smallest, said in an undertone, "I lived there for a fortnight when I first came to see Bellerub." And Mrs. Travers felt more than ever, as if walking in a dream, when she perceived beyond the rails of its veranda and visible from head to foot two figures in an armor of chainmail with pointed steel helmets crested with white and black feathers and guarding the closed door. A high bench draped in turkey cloth stood in an open space of the great audience shed. Lingard led her up to it. Georgensen on her other side closed the parasol calmly, and when she sat down between them the whole throng before her eyes sank to the ground with one accord, disclosing in the distance of the courtyard a lonely figure leaning against the smooth trunk of a tree. A white cloth was fastened round his head by a yellow cord. Its pointed ends fell on his shoulders, framing a thin dark face with large eyes. A silk cloak striped black and white fell to his feet, and in the distance he looked aloof and mysterious in his erect and careless attitude, suggesting assurance and power. Lingard, bending slightly, whispered into Mrs. Travers' ear that that man, apart and dominating the scene, was Damon, the supreme leader of the Illinans, the one who had ordered the capture of those gentlemen in order perhaps to force his hand. The two barbarous, half-naked figures covered with ornaments and charms, squatting at his feet with their heads enfolded in crimson and gold handkerchiefs, and with straight swords lying across their knees, were the Pangerans who carried out the order, and had brought the captives into the lagoon. But the two men in chain armor on watch outside the door of the small house, were Bellerup's two particular bodyguards, who got themselves up in that way only on very great occasions. They were the outward and visible sign that the prisoners were in Bellerup's keeping, and this was good, so far. The pity was that the great chief himself was not there. Then Lingard assumed a formal pose, and Mrs. Travers stared into the great courtyard, and with rows and rows of faces ranged on the ground at her feet felt a little giddy for a moment. Every movement had died in the crowd. Even the eyes were still under the variegated mass of colored headkerchiefs. While beyond the open gate a noble palm tree looked intensely black against the glitter of the lagoon and the pale incandescence of the sky, Mrs. Travers, gazing that way, wondered at the absence of Asim and Amata. But the girl might have been somewhere within one of the houses with the ladies of Bellerup's stockade. Then suddenly Mrs. Travers became aware that another bench had been brought out, and was already occupied by five men dressed in gorgeous silks and embroidered velvets, round-faced and grave. Their hands reposed on their knees, but one amongst them, clad in a white robe and with a large nearly black turban on his head, leaned forward a little with his chin in his hand. His cheeks were sunken, and his eyes remained fixed on the ground, as if to avoid looking at the infidel woman. She became aware suddenly of a soft murmur, and glancing at Lingard she saw him in an attitude of impassive attention. The momentous negotiations had begun, and it went on like this in low undertones with long pauses and in the immobility of all the attendants squatting on the ground, with the distant figure of Damon far off in the shade towering over all the assembly. But in him too, Mrs. Travers could not detect the slightest movement, while the slightly modulated murmurs went on enveloping her in a feeling of peace. The fact that she couldn't understand anything of what was said soothed her apprehensions. Sometimes a silence fell, and Lingard, bending toward her, would whisper, "It isn't so easy," and the stillness would be so perfect that she would hear the flutter of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.